This is Conor Lennon from UN News. A newly passed Security Council resolution on sexual violence in war reinforces the mandate of the UN's top official dealing with the issue, cementing a survivor-centred approach in all aspects of prevention and response. That's according to the UN's Special Representative on Sexual Violence in Conflict, Pramila Patten, in an in-depth interview with UN News following the resolution passed late last month. She said it was regrettable that stronger language on reproductive health and rights for women and girls had not been included, but it was nonetheless a powerful tool to ensure survivors received the care they need without discrimination. With some media reports characterising the resolution as watered down, Matt Wells asked Ms. Patten what she would ideally have liked to see pass.
Firstly, I don't agree that the resolution has been watered down significantly, as many media reports are claiming it to be. I agree that it's very regrettable that some important elements have been missed out. And in fact, the media has very much focused on the omission of previously agreed language around sexual and reproductive health. That calls on UN entities and donors to provide comprehensive health services, including sexual and reproductive health. What we have in this resolution is a call to member states to ensure that survivors receive the care required by their specific needs and without discrimination. I have a Security Council mandate, and I have to work with the tools given to me by the Security Council. And my priority today is really to explore how best to use this new resolution. And from a legal perspective, I think that the language in Resolution 2106 can and should continue to be relied upon, since the very preambular paragraph of the resolution in that paragraph, the Security Council reaffirms its commitment to the continuing and full implementation of all the resolutions on women, peace and security, including Resolution 2106. In terms of what ideally I would have liked to see in that resolution, certainly stronger language on sexual and reproductive health and rights, with explicit reference to access to contraceptive information and services, including emergency contraception, safe abortion and post-abortion care, especially that I deal with survivors of sexual violence, which are among the most pressing issues facing women affected by conflict. And for me, that omission is regrettable because I'm dealing with countries where most of the countries have very restrictive laws on abortion. For example, in DRC and Iraq, there's a total ban on abortion. In 12 of my conflict and post-conflict countries, abortion is only available if it is necessary to save the life of the woman. So it is quite problematic.
So in practical terms, how will this resolution change how your office and the UN overall goes about the work of combating sexual violence in conflict?
Well, this new resolution reinforces the existing architecture of the mandate. It provides additional tools. It strengthens justice and accountability. And especially it calls for a survivor-centered approach in all aspects of prevention and response to sexual violence. And for me, this is very significant. This is a resolution that actually reflects my own strategic priorities for the mandate. The resolution really distinguishes itself from previous resolutions in terms of the gaps that it actually addresses. For example, that very comprehensive focus on prevention through justice sector reform, through security sector reform, having prevention as a cross-cutting priority in the work of the Security Council, the strengthening of the monitoring, analysis and reporting arrangements, the continued training of peacekeeping personnel to ensure more proactive and effective preventive action by UN peacekeepers. It's all extremely useful for me. I'll just give you one example. I was in South Sudan and I met with survivors of sexual violence in the protection of civilian side who were talking about being raped as soon as they step out on the POC side, which is at the doorstep of UNMISS. And I had a conversation with the peacekeepers to engage with them and to see how best they can do preventive work, what needs to be done to prevent it from happening. It's also a resolution that addresses that recognizes root causes and a series of other factors which exacerbate sexual violence. And that's critical for me in terms of my work. And I have precisely made root causes a strategic priority. I think it's critical that we address structural inequalities, gender discrimination, but also underrepresentation of women in decision-making and leadership roles, discriminatory laws. We have for the first time a resolution that makes that link between sexual violence and illicit trade in natural resources, as well as the link between the disproportionate impact of sexual violence on women and girls and the accumulation and misuse of small arms and light weapons. But more importantly, there's a groundbreaking recognition of the importance of a survivor-centered approach, including a need for a survivor-centered and holistic concept of justice and accountability.
So what does a survivor-centered approach really mean to you and your office practically?
Well, what it means is that you put survivors at the center of everything that you do, you treat survivors with dignity, that you prioritize their rights, their needs, their wishes. It really entails creating a supportive environment in which the survivor's rights are respected and in which he or she is treated with dignity and respect. Because I really think that only such an approach can help to promote the survivor's recovery and her ability to identify and express needs and wishes. For example, for the first time, we have a resolution that recognizes that survivors are not a homogeneous group and that you have different categories of survivors.
Can be a him.
Yes. There is an explicit recognition of men and boys as victims of sexual violence, but other vulnerable groups, which include LGBTI persons. And so this is critically important in terms of the tailored response that is required. I have an advocacy mandate. I do not have a programmatic mandate, but I chair UN Action on Sexual Violence, which comprises 13 UN entities. So this resolution is key for the 13 UN entities, whether it is World Health Organization or UNFPA or UN Women or IOM, in terms of the service delivery on the ground.
So the 2018 annual report from the Secretary General discussed at the open debate paints a bleak picture of the trends and the patterns of conflict-related sexual violence in the countries covered. What's your office doing about this?
Well, indeed, the picture for the year 2018 is bleak. And in the 19 situations covered in the report, we see how it's marked by ongoing conflict, insecurity, poverty, and high incidence of conflict-related sexual violence. We see how women and girls continue to be targeted and subjected to rape. I see a lot of gang rape, a lot of many cases of sexual slavery, but also forced marriage, human trafficking, and other forms of sexual exploitation and abuse. In my office, I have a team of experts on the rule of law and sexual violence. In addition, with the catalytic funding that we provide through projects that we fund through UN Action, and they work very closely with these countries, most of the 19 countries, working closely with their national legal and judicial officials in governments, civil and military justice, to address impunity, to enhance criminal accountability, judicial capacity and responsiveness to victims. The team of experts is providing assistance in a broad range of areas, such as criminal investigation and prosecutions, collection, analysis, preservation and use of forensic evidence, military justice systems, investigation and prosecutions, legislative reform, whether it is criminal law reform or civil law reform. They do work in the area of protection of victims and witnesses. They do security sector oversight systems and bodies. For example, my team of experts just returned from South Sudan, where they have developed an action plan for the South Sudanese armed forces. We've seen very, very concrete progress. For example, in the DRC, the work and support provided by the team of experts has resulted in the prosecution of a significant number of emblematic cases. And more recently, with their support, the High Military Court has upheld a life sentence of a local parliamentarian and militia leader who had been found guilty of crimes against humanity for the rape of 39 children in Kavumu. Currently, they are supporting the government of DRC with the trial of a warlord known as Sheka for the alleged mass rape of 387 women in Walikale back in 2010. But the trial has just begun in Goma. In the Central African Republic, they have supported a specialized unit of police to investigate sexual and gender-based violence. And again, their work has led to a case of mass rape. The trial will start very soon, and I will be going to the Central African Republic very soon in early June to discuss also the establishment of a special court. In Guinea, the team of experts has very promptly, after the massacre in a stadium in 2009, whereby 109 women were raped, they have promptly supported a panel of judges in concluding its investigations, which culminated in the indictment of no less than 15 very high-ranking officials, including the former president, Dadis Camara himself, and other senior ministers at the time. It's ongoing work, and we sign, we get formal commitments from many of these countries in the form of a joint communique or framework of cooperation. But I do not have as much success when it comes to non-state actors.
Much harder to bring them to account.
Absolutely. And that is why one of the recommendations in the Secretary General's report was the establishment of a formal mechanism to monitor compliance. And that's something which unfortunately has not been retained. But the Secretary General has been requested in his next report to provide a gap assessment and to make very concrete recommendations to the Security Council. So it's work in progress. At least there is a recognition that there is a gap in the compliance regime, which needs to be addressed.
So progress, but a long and difficult journey still remains.
Absolutely.